The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 25th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, Catherine Reutlin. I will probably get that pronunciation better when I actually have her on and can ask her what it is. But we're going to be talking about how markets perpetuate racism. She's a senior policy analyst at Demos. Also,
we will be talking with D. Brian Burghardt. He runs the Fatal Encounters Project, which is basically a project he started about 2 years ago where he is crowdsourcing all the police shootings that happen across the nation. And we're going to discuss with him his work and what he's learned since starting it.
Also, got for you a couple of stories about ISIS or ISIL. I'm going to talk about how they use social media and the role of social media in warfare, global terrorism, and drug cartels in 2014. Obviously a great fun half story. Also, our old buddy Dinesh D'Souza. Now that Google has finished conspiring against him, he has some interesting insights on ISIL or ISIS. And, of course, if I was in fifth grade and I just said that, I would follow it up with, not. Also, what else we got?
Well, we got tons of stuff. We got some clips for you. You know, the usual stuff from Fox News. They're at it. And we'll break it down. We'll break them down.
We will break them.
That's what we'll do.
We will break them, my friends.
Also, interesting stats about the lawmakers who are trying to raise money by doing that for ASL, by doing that water bucket challenge. You'll find some very interesting things about what their true heart lies, their real heart
lies. Where their real priorities are. I just got to say, right before we get to the break, Sam will be back tomorrow, and the classiest and coolest ice bucket challenge, hands down, George W. Bush. I'm just kidding. Patrick Stewart. Did you see what Patrick Stewart did?
I did not see Patrick Stewart.
He had a literal ice bucket, and he wrote a check for the research, and then he made himself a mixed drink and put an ice cube in it.
Very cool.
He's a very cool man. All right, we'll be right back. Thanks for listening, folks.
Keep it, cause it's the best secret. I rock a vest, prestigious, Cuban link flooded Jesus. Intellects watching Kathy Lee and Regis. My actions are one with the seasons. A tech squeezing, executioner, wintertime I rock a fur, mega popular, center of attraction, climaxing. They be laughing, they hop from sniffing coke, off a 20 sit, Andrew Jackson. City lights spark a New York night. Rossi and Martini sipping, Sergio Ticini flipping, mad pies, low price. I blow dice and throw them. 45 by my manifest to do or die slogan. My rolling 10 M3s, 20 guards popping willies on Kawasaki's. Hip hop's got me on some old, spraying shots like a drum roll. Blanking out, never miscount the shells, my gun hole. I don't stunt, I regulate. Henny and Sprite, I separate. Watch a crab marinate. I'm all about text and good jokes and sex. Israelite books, holding government names from Nest. MCs are crawling out every hole in the slum. You be alright like blood money in a pimp's. Currency.
see is made and trusted a messiah. I'm spinning it to get higher. Earth, wind, and fire, singing reasons why I'm up early. Trustworthy as a nine at bus early. Sunshine on my grill, I spill. Remy on imaginary graves. Put my hat on my waves. Latter-day Saints say religion.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Catherine Reuchlin. She's a senior policy analyst at Demos. Catherine, how are you?
I'm great today. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. Did I get your name correct?
Close enough. Closer than most people.
Closer than most people. Okay. I didn't really grading on a curve on your last name. Okay. Why don't you say it one time so everybody gets it?
And my name is Catherine Reuchlin.
Catherine Reuchlin.
I'm a policy analyst at Demos.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry about that, Catherine. But it's really great to have you on. And you have a couple of recent pieces that you've written for the Demos blog, the Demos Policy Shop. And I want to focus specifically on one that you wrote very recently called Markets Don't Stop Racism, But They Can Perpetuate It. And before we get into the specifics of this write-up, which is really, really valuable. Everybody should look at it, and there's a link to it on the Majority Report blog. I want to start because I think this comes at a very opportune time, because we're seeing this sort of push of libertarian talking points as a sort of answer for Republicans and the right in America. I mean, there's some recognition even in those circles that this sort of abominable record in terms of reaching African-American voters, Hispanic voters, is obviously just really detrimental to long-term political success. And the kind of answers that you're seeing from everybody from Rand Paul to Paul Ryan to Rand Paul are – you know, looking at that markets can supersede and sort of eliminate racism because they're colorblind. And I'd like you to speak directly to that talking point as a way of setting the frame for this conversation.
Sure. You know, I think that libertarians and also, you know, conservative political figures like Paul Ryan are in agreement with many Americans in the belief that economic growth has the power to improve living conditions and, as a result, advance racial equity. And I would agree with that as well in a general sense. But because we've ignored the reality of racist outcomes and unequal history for so long, structuring markets with race-neutral rules actually reinforce the differences that have been accumulated over time. You know, the economic model that talks about racism in the market is a conception of markets as a bunch of rational actors and racism as an additional cost placed on a racist employer.
Right.
So in the labor market, it's conceived as paying extra in order to avoid hiring people that you don't want to be around. But that's not actually the way that racism plays out in markets in general. In fact, you know, one way that you can have a racist market outcome without any racist, you know, in power of employment choices is by just intensifying the racial competition between workers so that black and white workers don't bargain together. And as that competition intensifies, it puts downward pressure on the wages of both. And in that sense, employers can actually benefit from racism in the market, and there's no incentive to eliminate it.
Right. That's a great example of that. And we know that that's sort of the history of the racial divide. I mean, and particularly that's a whole subtext, I think, of obviously even the history of the South in America, and a real foundational reason of why the South has lower working conditions, lower wages, and a very, very weak labor movement. So that makes perfect sense. I mean, another example that you raise in this piece that I'd like you to speak to is also just – I mean, and this is a really – blunt example of this, but like the private corrections industry. I mean, that's an industry that has a direct stake in different racial outcomes.
That's right. When you give a company an incentive incentive to see stricter, harsher sentencing as an economic benefit, well, that company is all for it. And, you know, the Corrections Corporation of America, the actual people involved, the shareholders, the executives, may or may not be racist, but they absolutely benefit from the institutionalized racism in our corrections policies. So you see a company like Corrections Corporation of America, also the GEO Group, LaSalle, there's actually a handful of companies in this industry, probably not a competitive market, actually, because there's so few. You see them actually go out and advocate for laws that disproportionately punish people of color. Things like I think it's SB 1070 in Arizona that demanded that folks be able to prove their citizenship at any time, because they actually house the ICE prisoner population, and it's an economic benefit for them to forward these racially disparate laws.
And then let's take it to this sort of other extreme. So if we're talking, and I think it is actually shocking for some people to hear, maybe not necessarily in this audience, but I think the notion that we still have a major and sort of growing interest in a private prison industry is pretty shocking for some people. But if we take it to the other extreme and we look at the sort of benign markets, and I'm using that in quotation marks, but the things that particularly this libertarian Republican wave and even folks like Paul Ryan would really point to, of this, you know, this idealized market of the sharing economy, Silicon Valley, apps, services like Uber. I've noticed Republicans have gotten really excited about Uber, which is, you know, for people who aren't in the big urban areas, is basically just a car order service over your phone. So you could sort of have a somewhat similar experience of having a car service on call for you. Even in these areas that are sort of these, you know, supposedly very evolved forms of market activity, we still see, you know, there's a lot of wage and labor challenges built into them. They're not necessarily great news for people who drive cars in the long term, as an example. But racism can still show up as if we're taking Uber as an example. You rate your driver, and your rating of them is basically not only determines it essentially determines whether or not they stay employed with Uber. Customer ratings. And we've seen endless studies around things in this area of the sharing economy and peer economy that subconscious racial biases are still at work there.
That's right. I think Uber is a really great example of the way both these subconscious interpersonal prejudices can come out in markets, but also the kind of business as usual race neutral laws actually pass through that racism into the market as well. So you have a real tendency toward interpersonal preference or prejudice and perceptions of disparity, especially when labor markets are tight. You know, people really, this is something that most of us have to check occasionally and say, oh, you know, what does my response in this situation mean? And maybe people should do that more often when faced in a situation like that. But there's this perception that racism is the fault of, you know, wrong-headed thinking or just a few individual actors, like in this case, where you have interpersonal racism that determines the fate of your driver's career. But racist outcomes aren't just at this interpersonal level. They're actually business as usual within the norms that we consider actually ethical in a market like Uber. Right. For example, what kind of person has to take a side job driving around that offers no guarantee of hours, no workplace protections, no insurance coverage, no employee benefits, right? That's a person who's in a very fragile place in the labor market. And who is more likely to be in that position? People of color, you know, African Americans whose unemployment rate is double that of white Americans, you know, who even when are lucratively employed, those jobs tend to be not as good. They tend to have, you know, less likely to offer benefits, lower wages, lower annual incomes. So, you know, it's not even just that interpersonal level, but actually how we segment people into these unprotected jobs in the first place.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the key point, right? Because all of this discourse of markets as this purifying neutral force, and the only aspect that racism could play in them would be an irrational decision on the part of an employer or organization or company, is ignoring the fact that what you're laying out, which is that many employers and companies benefit precisely from people being in marginalized and weakened positions, and that there's a collective aspect to this, that whole fantasy is fundamentally committed to ignoring as just an empirical reality.
That's right. What it really ignores is that these racial inequalities are cumulative and pushed through from one market to the next. So you don't necessarily fix racist outcomes by addressing individual behaviors. What you actually need is a recognition of the outcomes, and admission would be a great first step, and then to treat them individually in a way that not only perpetuates greater equity, but also reduces the stigma that's associated with the outcomes, even though their root is actually a historical social construction.
Right. What about, particularly in the in really tough economic times and changing economic times, how does racial bias play out in terms of basically, I guess, bluntly speaking, the broader white community or people who are in more privileged positions? How does the data show we're in a bad position? Things are tighter, things are leaner. Maybe we should think a bit more broadly and collectively to sort of ensure better outcomes for everybody. Or should I pull back and sort of grasp what I have, and I'm less concerned about these broader themes? What does the data show with regard to that?
Well, as I'm sure you can predict, fear is a great motivator. Yeah. And it really drives people who live in a state of fear to be insular and, you know, to try to stake out a space for their own security. And often that means trying to create a distinction that puts you ahead of someone else. Mm-hmm. And that is to your advantage if you can count on someone being behind you in the line at the unemployment office, right? So what we've seen in psychological studies is that during recessions in particular, people are more prone to perceiving people of color as different. That means that, you know, if shown a picture of a person with maybe European features and darker skin, or maybe African features and lighter skin, they're more likely to conceive of them as the other, as non-white, as a member of a different social group if they're under conditions of scarcity. And that means that at a time like the recession, we have problems of people perceived differences that intensify the kind of interpersonal racism that operates in markets, at the same time that we have this cumulative effect of the disadvantages of people of color in markets as well. So that means that if you're an African American coming into the recession, not only are you twice as likely to lose your job, and if you manage to get a job, it's going to pay you less, and if you do lose your job, you have a tenth of the wealth to fall back on. Not only are all of those things true, but in addition to that, people look at you differently as well.
Right. And then, so there's sort of a three-step process here, because the other point that you raised and you're alluding to there is you're already talking about, before this game even begins, the demographics and the realities of much, much lower baselines in terms of wealth, social capital, and connections, as an example, the African-American community. Then you have economic recession and real, you know, implosion in 2008, 2009 that hits everybody, basically. I mean, most people. And then, you know, we move in response to that. I mean, the United States, not as extreme as Europe, and there was some stimulus and some response, but really mainly an era of austerity with attacks and hits on government that, again, disproportionately affect like a black middle class. So that those are the sort of three steps.
That's right. And as a result, you know, from the recession, our racial equity in the United States actually went back in time. We lost the gains that we made in terms of equality when the economy was booming in the 90s, and we're back in our labor markets to where we were during the civil rights movement. And that is, you know, what makes us such an urgent problem right now, but also really shows that there's never a time in our history when inclusion and opportunity for people of color was not an urgent problem, right? Even in the 90s when we were making gains, this was a very fragile system. And because we didn't institutionalize those systems, because we didn't, you know, recognize and perpetuate the practices that would better our equality of opportunity, we've actually lost it in a very short time.
Right. And you know, so getting back to the broader context that we're in, so if on one extreme, the Marco Rubios, the Paul Ryans, the Rand Pauls of the world are doubling down on a market fantasy, a sort of story that has never really existed in reality, and has been shown to the extent to which we've actually experimented with policies and implemented policies inspired by it, really disastrous results, whether in financial deregulation or austerity or wherever else. On the other hand, and it can't come fast or soon enough, we are finally seeing in some areas a real conversation about structural wealth inequality and how that's holding back not only things that good liberals like us care about, which is, like justice and equality and opportunity and eroding our democracy, but it's also really hurting economic activity, and it's really degrading the labor force, and it poses some very long-term threats to the economy that even, people like any kind of serious analyst working for a bank would worry about if they were thinking in any sort of strategic or long-term terms. But it seems that the challenge, though, that's very interesting, and because on one hand, it is very appealing to say there is this inequality crisis that really does cut across many different sectors. It's someone who used to be comfortably in the upper middle class who's seen their wages go down and down and down. It's a privileged kid who got to go to a good college who's entering a sort of like airless market, just a intern to internship, right? And maybe getting supported by their parents if they're lucky. And all of that is real and all of that is urgent. But at the same time, there still is this racial split that's so implicated in all of the data and all of the bigger picture. And that just seems to be a conversation that we still just really don't want to have. And, and including very much as the Democratic Party or as progressives, how do we start to have this broader inequality conversation that we need to have that implicates everyone, but at the same time highlight and forward what you're writing about, which is there are very specific racial components of it?
That's right. I think that the events in Ferguson over the last couple of weeks really demonstrate why this is a crossover issue between economic inequality and democratic equality and participation. I mean, even the big institutions like the IMF and, the World Economic Forum in Davos and the S&P, who point to inequality as a major social problem, identify it as a problem because it destabilizes the political system. It undermines people's sense that they can function in the economy, that they can function in the democracy. And that's a huge problem for everyone. So it's time for our political system, to get past the idea of post-racial as a sense that, we've created these social conditions that make it very unsavory and socially costly to have explicit interpersonal racism, right? Just the kind of direct admitted prejudice is at this point, unsavory, not politically tenable. But at the same time, as a result of that, we've made it very difficult for people to talk about race in general. And the last time we took, the equality of opportunity and inclusion for people of color seriously was the enforcement measures of the Civil Rights Act. Right. Since then, we've not only stopped working toward and enforcing equality. We've actually directly undermined it by rolling back voting rights, increasing residential segregation, increasing our incarceration rates, especially for people of color, right? And in those areas, it's really ahistorical to even discuss them without a discussion of race, but we've made it very uncomfortable to do so. And what I think that we really need is a rising black leadership, rising black inclusion in the political process, rising representation among the people who are most likely to be affected by these issues. And that ties in with, you know, the Supreme Court's recent evisceration of the Voting Rights Act, which is just going to make getting there that much harder.
That's exactly right. And, the final thought that I would just like to run by and get your feedback on, and I know about this from reading about it. I don't remember how old I was when this happened, but I was, I was quite young. Not certainly not following politics, but that famous moment where, President Clinton, when he was running for president in 1991 or 1992, had, the Sister Soldier moment where he condemned this rap artist for some lyrics. I don't remember what the lyrics were. He did it at a forum, I think, with Jesse Jackson. And this moment of this sort of racial opportunism is heralded as this, that's when Bill Clinton really showed that the Democratic Party was not going to be, the kind of obvious code word was special interests, not going to be held captive by these special interests and really represent all of America. And it seems, we had that moment with President Clinton, which, and rhetorically, President Clinton's been amazing in other ways. But, it wasn't just rhetoric that he, while the 90s did benefit, broader communities through economic growth and through some of his tax policies and some of his investment policies. But there was also signing a slew of prison and criminal bills that hurt African-American and Hispanic communities disproportionately. There was also welfare reform that absolutely, especially in light of the recession, is really laid bare for what it was and what it is. And then this post-racial thing that you're talking about under the Obama era. And it's like is it time for a white politician, in fact, to have a reverse Sister Soldier moment where someone comes out and says, look, this history is still impacting us every single day. Here's the data. Here's the reality. We need to deal with this now. And it's part of solving every single kind of festering crisis and problem that we have in this country. I mean, is that politically tenable, or is that just sort of our fantasy in Manhattan of what we would like to see?
It's much easier for those of us who live in areas that are diverse areas to understand that this actually would not be a Sister Soldier moment suggests that there's an extreme position to take, that we need to, talk about this as some sort of zero-sum game where somebody needs to win and somebody needs to lose, and that we have to align at the farthest extreme of this. It's actually not that at all. It would basically just be a wake up and open your eyes kind of scenario. And it seems like it's just more and more mainstream, not only as, the population urbanizes in general, but as demographics shift and these inequalities deepen and worsen, we're not going to be talking about a small interest group. I mean, this is the population of the United States, coming up soon. It's fully half of the population of the United States are going to be people of color. Nobody can say, oh, you're just pandering to an interest group anymore.
You're just pandering to America.
That's right. Exactly. You're just pandering to, voters and democracy. So,
Well, maybe the Koch brothers would say that. But at any rate, Catherine Reuchlin, I really, really appreciate your time. Senior policy analyst at Demos.
Thank you so much for having me on the show to talk with you today.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks.
All right, folks. I think that was great. If I dare say
so
myself.
I think so, too.
She was quite really on point. We're going to take a brief break here. And Matt, who are you going to talk to again?
I will be talking with D. Brian Burghardt. He is the editor of the Reno News and Review, but we will be talking about his project, Fatal Encounters, which seeks to track every police shooting in the country because
– That's a crowdsourced platform.
It
huh?
is. Wow. And it's surprising to me, and we'll get into this further, that there is no agency that tracks this.
Fascinating. All right. We'll be right back, folks.
All right, we are back. This is the Majority Report, and I am joined by my co-host, Michael Brooks.
Howdy.
And my
Hey, how are you doing?
Oh, wait, hold on 1 second. My name is Matt Binder, and joining us now is D. Brian Burkhart. He's the editor of Reno News and Review, and we're going to talk about his project, Fatal Encounters, which is a crowdsourced project to create a national database of basically – all police-involved shooting in the country. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. And it's not all police-involved shooting. It's only deaths.
Deaths. Got it. Okay. Got it. So I'm glad you're on the show today because, obviously, this has been in the news. And it's something that actually shocked me when I was reading this. I was familiar with the Fatal Encounters Project. I had come across it before, but I didn't. But I didn't realize though that I thought you were actually just creating something for the public or in some sort of way, getting specifics in terms of, you know, maybe there's someone out there tracking, like I said before, all police involved shooting or something. And I wasn't quite understanding that there wasn't anyone out there doing that. But I'm shocked to know that there is no agency or no big organization who specializes in collecting data. There's nobody doing this.
Isn't it incredible?
I'm shocked. And I'm glad you're here. So let's start with, what is Fatal Encounters?
Okay, Fatal Encounters it's just as you described it. It's a database that records people who are killed by law enforcement. It's not just shootings. It's if they get in a car accident or asphyxiation or something like that. It's not incarcerated people. That's another needed database, but I'm not doing it. So the idea is to compare certain things, like the race of the person killed, the age, the gender, whether there were obvious signs of mental illness. So we can look at those statistics and determine if one area of the country is performing better than another area. And if that's true, then we can change policies, procedures, training, protocol to get the best results in kind of crisis situations.
It's like I said before, I mean, especially hearing your what you just said, it's stunning to me that no one has previously, I mean, I'm talking about those directly involved, aka the police. I mean, that they wouldn't want to have this data so they could create policies. I mean, even lawmakers, obviously, to create policies that can stop unnecessary police violence.
It's crazy.
So you have this.
Literally crazy.
It is. It is. I'm glad you actually wrote this piece too. You wrote something for Gawker that I read on Friday, and it's and it's called "What I've Learned from 2 Years Collecting Data on Police Killings," and I just basically want you to discuss what you've learned, because it's, I mean, there's one line especially that just, I mean, it should be obvious, but I guess to just see it, someone writing it, I mean, you especially, who's been working on this project, to see you just basically say this, what the biggest thing you've taken away from the project was, it's stunning to me, and it's true.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing I took away is the reason we don't have a database is because somebody doesn't want it.
Yes.
I mean, it seems almost too obvious to say, but God, this is the 21st century where every detail of what kind of gum you chew or, you know, where you buy your sunglasses is available to somebody. It's databased. And this kind of information is not. It's just, I keep calling it crazy because I don't know a better word.
Yeah, I mean, so what is some of the things you've gone through when trying to collect this data so you can make this database? You go into the different agencies that have caused you, I guess, trouble in trying to collect this.
Let's. My original idea for this was that I wanted to make public records requests of every single and local law enforcement agency in the United States. That was actually the part of it that I was going to crowdsource.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the FBI because they have this thing called the Uniform Crime Report.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with it?
I'm not, no.
It's their main data point for crime.
Okay.
So they collect it from, I think it's around 16,000 state and local law enforcement agencies. It's a voluntary thing, but almost everyone participates. So all I wanted was their mailing list. I wanted their database so that I could figure out a way to enable people to make public records requests in their own local area. You know, this is all just conceptual at that point because I didn't know how easy or how hard crowdsourcing this was going to be. So originally they turned down the document or the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, saying that the information did not exist. Well, it's a bald-faced lie.
Yeah.
Of course it exists. They have to send out their mailing list. So I responded to that email to that request, and I made it broader. So basically that where the one was very targeted, all I want is your mailing list. I had to ask for, a much larger thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did was, and this is, I guess it's probably over 8 months or so, you know, that's kind of the game. They think they can outweigh you, so even if they do eventually give you the information, you can't use it because got a new job, or your editor told you to move on, or something along those lines. So when they did finally respond, they responded with a CD. What they had done was, instead of sending me the electronic version of the database, which is completely within my rights to ask for, they printed it out, and it was on, the original printing was on legal size sheets, and then they printed it onto 8.5 by 11 sheets, and then they scanned those as JPEGs, not even PDFs, so I could scan them. And then they sent me that.
Wow.
So even though they maybe technically responded, they sent me something that was absolutely useless. I mean, it was, there's no way that wasn't intentional.
Oh, it's like impossible to even, you know, scrape the data off the way they sent
it. Yeah, exactly. You can look at it. It's on the post section of fatalencounters.org. It's in the Freedom of Information Act updates is what it's called. So at any rate, there was another agency that I discovered while doing my research called the U.S. Census of State and Local Law Enforcement Agencies that actually has almost all the state and local law enforcement agencies in the United States. And so I just called their lead statistician and said, would you mind sending me your database? And he sent it to me on an Excel spreadsheet. It took a couple weeks because he was busy. But yeah, so on my website under public records tool or something, under tools, all 17,985 state and local law enforcement agencies can be checked by state and then county. And all I have to do is print it out and write the FOIA, and it can be done. A guy, a lawyer from Texas, actually called me on Saturday asking for all the state and local law enforcement agencies in Texas, and he's doing a public records request of all of them for me.
So they're making it as hard for you as possible, obviously. But
that's the top. I mean, you get down to the bottom, like at the county level or even the state level.
Oh, yes.
For example, I'm trying to make some comparison between Nevada and Idaho, and so I sent the Idaho State Police simple public records request. And they sent it back and said, we have no data that matches your request. And then, so I'm doing my regular research, and I discover, an incident where a state patrolman killed a guy on the freeway. So I sent a link to the person who turned down my request, and I said, hey, how is this possible you don't have any records of this? And then she gets back to me, well, we have records, we're just not going to give them to you.
Wow.
Almost in that many words. So I got in a battle with, I can't remember what her title is. It's like Assistant Attorney General, something like that. I could look it up if it's important. But now she's arguing that that public records laws don't force her to do this, basically. But they do,
Because
I can read their public records law. So, and then you get farther down to the county. I went through battles. The first story in this six-part series I did was basically about the battles just trying to get documents in Washoe County, which I've lived here since 1984. I know these people, and still they battle me.
There's more to this, too, though, and you go into it in your piece for Gawker about what else you learned. And, I mean, there's no way that you're the first journalist to try to get this information.
You wouldn't think so.
So what is going on that end of things where journalism and the reporters are just basically going along with the with what police are saying, oh, we can't get this information, fine. And these things aren't being reported.
Right. And that's the game. It's like if they put up enough of a delay tactic, reporters have to move on. They have to. Most news organizations don't have money to sue for public records. It's as simple as that. I mean, like Gannett, for example, sues. That's maybe why it's better here in Reno than in many places.
Mm.
But mostly, if you tell your editor, yeah, they say it's going to be 6 weeks before I can do this story, the editor is going to say, well, go do something on the on cleaning up the river. You know, they'll move the reporter along.
So from the information you've compiled so far, it's been about, you said 2 years you've been since you've been running the project?
Actually, that's kind of an exaggeration. I've actually been collecting information since about the beginning of this year.
Okay.
So I've got three levels of how it works. I've got about 2,000 that's just in the cloud drive, hasn't been formatted even well enough to get onto a spreadsheet.
Mm.
I've got one spreadsheet that's just stuff I scraped off the internet, like Wikipedia or various newspaper databases around the country. You know, but it's missing information that's crucial to what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a second layer. That's the crowdsourcing part that I'm using right now, where somebody looks at that information, they basically fill in a form on my website, and they add the information. Like sometimes it's just zip code or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Because in the reports that you find, some of this information, the reporters didn't get this information from, you know, the police or whatever agency they went through, and that's what's missing, basically. Like, for example, when a newspaper reports about a police-involved shooting, they might not add the background of it, the race of the person, et cetera. Is that correct?
Right. Because, okay. I mean, according to AP style or just kind of journalistic ethics, you generally don't report race in crime unless it is like a hate crime where it's germane to the story.
Mm-hmm.
But as we're discovering in the United States, when there's
it's always germane to
the
story.
An officer involved killing, it's always germane. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So mental illness is another huge factor. In 2 years in Washoe County, four people were killed by police, and three of them were mentally ill, and the officer knew it when they went there. They were called for a suicide. So if they had better training, and I think the training around here is pretty good. I've worked with some members of the Reno Police Agency that are specifically trained for mentally ill people in crisis. So if the training were better 2 years ago, I have a feeling that some of those people would have survived. And if only two did, it'd be 50%. You know.
Yeah. So what you've discovered basically in terms of the from what the data you've collected is that, you would say that the mentally ill and black males are the most, usually the victim of deadly police shootings.
That part of it kind of got simplified. It relates to urban density, This doesn't come directly from the data. It's just kind of what I think as I look at the data, because we haven't gotten down to real number crunching yet.
Mm.
The more urban dense a place is, the more likely, the darker the person's going to be who gets killed.
Mm.
So if you go to one of these spread out western cities, that person's going to be brown. If you go to a very low urban density, like a small town in Nebraska, that person's going to be mentally ill and white.
Uh-huh.
So the race spectrum goes from urban dense to not urban dense, black to white, and then it seems to be a greater percentage of mentally ill in lower dense places. And I would theorize that's because in those kind of less wealthy areas, the police don't get the training to deal with mentally ill people.
Interesting.
But they do in the big cities, so that's why
yes.
It seems like there's a spectrum, sort of.
So what has any? I mean, I know you've only been doing this for a short time, regardless of whether it's been the beginning of this year or 2 years now. That's short for what we're talking about, regardless. But but has any agency or law enforcement at all tried to reach out to you and on their own, not you trying to pull data from them and try to say, you know, we want to use this information you're collecting to help us?
Sort of. Uh-huh. The president of the New York City Police Union sent me some information about people, about officer-involved shootings. So he's trying to help get the information in there, I presume, because he realizes what its use is. So has anybody said, do you have enough numbers that we can figure something out? No, nobody has yet.
So what I mean, was there a specific event that maybe you were reporting on or you saw that made you say, you know, I got to look for this? And then when you found that there was no such thing, you decided this is what I need to do?
Yeah, there were two, actually. Mm-hmm. I was driving home from work one afternoon, and right through downtown, downtown Reno, just past the river, and I could see this scene where there were just cop cars, just like somebody had stirred up an ant's nest, you know. It was just filled, and I just knew that somebody had been killed there. It was obvious, even though I didn't stop, I didn't talk to anyone. So I went home, and I immediately started searching. I just wanted to know how often that happens in Washoe County or even Nevada or just anywhere. And that information was not available. It just a giant black hole. So I just kind of blew it off, to be honest. You know, I thought maybe my search was not deep enough or something. So then a few months later, I was reading, I thought I read it on Gawker, but it must have been somewhere else because I couldn't find the original, about this kid down at the University of Southern Alabama. And he was, I believe he was 18 years old. And he showed up at the cop station there, stark naked, on drugs, I mean, obviously unarmed. Mm-hmm. He weighed, I think, about 130 pounds, just a little kid.
Yeah.
And he went there, and my gut tells me he went there for help, and the cop came out, guns drawn. Those two never got within 5 feet of each other, and Gil Collar ended up dead.
Wow.
Shot in the chest. Just killed. Uh-huh. No less lethal methods attempted. No call for backup. You know, I mean, and this is me looking at it from Reno, Nevada. I don't actually know if he did attempt to call backup or whatever.
Mm.
But again, I went, God, how often does that happen? And that's when I came across a story that had been done in Las Vegas, Nevada, of all places, that mentioned this lack of a database, that nobody tracks this information. So that's when I decided at that moment that I was going to track it. And then I started working to figure out how to do it.
I'm very glad you do, because this is – I mean, we talked about it at the beginning, but I can't get over this. I mean, it's the paragraph that just in your article in Gawker that just draws you in to the point where you just, like, you know, it seems so obvious, but just to see it written down, you know, the fact that there is no such database is because there's no government agency that wants you to know this information. I mean,
right.
we're in a world where they collect so much information, and it comes out that they do, and you think this would be one of the things that they would want you to know they collect. And even if they didn't, you think that would eventually come out too. But I am just shocked that there is
It's appalling. It really is appalling. And the thing is, they have the method to do it.
Oh,
they
easily.
Have the UCR. They could easily add a line item to collect that information. It's the fact that they don't is clear indication that they don't want to. I mean, that's kind of horrifying.
I mean, even you would think that even the very fact of creating a database alone would show that, you know, we want this out there because we care. It's boggling that they wouldn't even do that.
It's boggling. It's boggling.
So I want to make
sure. And hopefully through this kind of media attention, I mean, just in like the last, basically since Ferguson, USA Today did a major story on the lack of a database. NPR did a major story on the lack of a database. Scripps News did a story on the lack of a database. The problem is they hadn't noticed my database before they did their stories, but, you know, it's mine's just a baby. I mean, literally, that thing launched in February, so it's not 10% of where it needs to be.
Mm. Well, I'm sure you're well far ahead than anything else out there.
It's the biggest it exists.
Yeah.
It's just not big enough.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yes. And I think I want to get this information out there so it could become big enough or big as it needs to be. The website is fatalencounters.org. You can help by just going to that site and reading what needs to be done. You can help crowdsource this information. If I understand correctly, you have stories, accounts up there that just needs background added. And so people,
exactly.
So people don't really need to go out there blind as to what they need to look for. They can – you have information for them that they just need to fill in the blanks.
And, exactly.
And so please, if anyone's interested or has the time, fatalencounters.org, D. Brian Burkhart of the Reno News and Review and of fatalencounters.org. Thank you so much for joining us today and telling us what you've learned since creating this project.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
It's unbelievable. That's our go-to phrase, but it really is.
I mean, when I heard about this project, I can't remember how long ago, maybe like a month or two. There was an article or something I saw, and I just quickly, you know, clicked the link, and it took me there, and I looked over it, and it didn't hit me at first. And then I read what I mean is what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it hit, and then I read the article that came out Friday in Gawker by our guest Brian Burkhart, and I did not realize at all that there was nothing out there that collects this. I mean, I assume that if there was even a private governmental database, that by now someone would have said something just so it's out there that, you know, we are doing something. I mean, that's not – even if you want to keep the information private for whatever reason, you think you'd at least want it in the public for at least good PR that, you know, we are collecting stuff so we can figure out what's going on. Maybe it is, and we haven't heard about it, and it's some really deeply held secret in some government agency, whether it be local, state.
There could be an internal process
federal,
for
yes.
it, but clearly this is not.
I mean,
this is obviously something that hasn't been prioritized in any way.
I mean, you could find information about basically almost everything. You think you would? I mean, and these incidents are publicly reported. I mean. It's unbelievable. I'm glad someone's – and I know Deadspin's also trying to put together a list of all police-involved shootings, which is different from Brian's. His is deadly police shootings or violence in general. Fatalencounters.org. Go there. Check it out. It's crazy stuff. It really – I can't believe that there's no one out there. How is even like some political organization not have hired some data firm to collect this stuff previously?
I don't know.
It's amazing. All right. We will try to make you all feel a bit better.
A little bit less glum. We've explained basically.
And now I'm already thinking of some of the stories I'm bringing up in the better half, and I'm already backtracking a bit.
We really have been Sam styling it recently.
Yeah,
We will try to
pace the stories, so we leave you on a note that makes you feel optimistic.
And of course, you can join us and share your optimism with us through IMing the show or calling us. That
yes,
number
please.
You can reach us at is
nothing will make me feel better than you calling 646-257-3920 or IMing us through the app, which you can download at majorityapp.com, and saying, hey, Matt, you heard about the latest Bitcoin exchange company that went under? Nothing would make me feel more happy and optimistic.
Well, nothing would make me feel more happy and optimistic than some libertarian calling up to try to explain why my guest today is wrong. And markets really are blind and magical, and they'll overcome racism, and racism doesn't even exist, and Uber is the best thing since penicillin, whatever other fantasy you're cooking up in your basement. Bring it to us.
Nothing would make me feel better than Bush and Shane sending in an RT.com link saying why Ukraine is bad and Russia is good.
Russia solving AIDS and Obama Hitler, RT.com.
Nothing would make me feel better than some MRA IMing a calling to the show saying how actually men's issues are the most important, except for this one where the majority of men get shot and killed by police. That's one we don't really worry about.
All right. I think they've gotten our specs. Okay, folks, you can become a member of the show, and you should become a member of this fine program by going to majorityreport.fm/member.
You could also just click become a member when you go to majority.fm.
Whatever. It's very easy. Getting to the become a member page is basically as easy as becoming a member.
Yes.
If you don't want to deal with PayPal, send us an email at majorityreporters.com. We will send
majorityreporters@gmail.com. Leave this to me.
majorityreporters@gmail.com. And you will get an address from us that you could send a check to. Plenty of people do that. Whatever the case may be, join up, support this excellent program.
At the very least, you should be buying all of your stuff you buy through Amazon through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference whatsoever in your purchase price or in your purchase in general. The only thing that happens is that Amazon will notice a difference in how much they get to keep, because they got to stick a little teeny bit of their profit into our pocket. You could also support this show by buying all your fair trade coffee and chocolates through justcoffee.coop. That's .coop. Use coupon code majority and you get 10% off your entire order.
And that's just a win for everybody. Great company, helps the workers, you get a great product, and you help support your favorite show.
Exactly. I'm trying to think of this. Oh, subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/SamCedar. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/majorityreport. Follow us on Twitter at majorityfm. And most importantly, we made a call before the break, and I just want to make this call again. You can help this show greatly for free without spending money on becoming a member. If you're already a member, if you don't buy stuff through Amazon, or if you do, again, regardless of what you do, you should be going to iTunes and leaving us a review. Because it helps us go up in the iTunes rankings, which helps people say, that looks interesting. That show is rising the rankings. Let's see what's up with the Majority Report.
Let's check it out.
So we will see you in the better half.
Give everybody the number again.
646-257-3920. Farewell, freebies. You should become a member if you want to listen to some more Majority Report. Sam's back tomorrow. Members, see you in a second. Members, we will see you in less than a second.
Sitting up the pain.